Ed Koch was sworn into office as the mayor of New York in 1978, and as the authors of a new book about him write, he became a national celebrity, a pop culture character. He wrote the 1985 bestseller Mayor. He was on television so often, on shows ranging from Saturday Night Live to Romper Room, that he was invited to join AFTRA, the Radio and TV Performers Union. Ed Koch's celebrity is not the subject of the new book by Jack Newfield and Wayne Barrett. Their book, City for Sale, is about the scandals and corruption connected to Koch. During his third and current term, a dozen major city leaders and nearly 100 minor officials have been convicted of crimes ranging from bribery to extortion. Newfield and Barrett are two of New York's leading investigative reporters, and they've broken many stories related to Koch, including a story that greatly expanded the Bess Meyerson scandal. Jack Newfield is my guest today. He reported on New York City politics for 24 years for the Village Voice. Earlier this year, he left to become the deputy city editor for investigations at the New York Daily News. For 10 of his years at The Voice, Newfield frequently collaborated with his co-author Wayne Barrett, who is still at The Voice. I asked Jack Newfield if he thought Ed Koch's celebrity interfered with the performance of Ed Koch, mayor.
Not really. I think he was very good at it, that the people began to perceive him as the personification of New York City, as a sassy, funny, wise-ass kind of personality, and I think that was not his problem. I think his problem was making deals with corrupt political leaders in exchange for power rather than money. But I think the celebrity was a sideshow to the main drama of, you know, someone who was intelligent and idealistic becoming corrupted by power.
Can you run down some of the organized crime ties to the people who he was associated with?
The three principal political leaders who made him mayor and tried to make him governor all had substantial organized crime connections. Meet Esposito, who was the Democratic county leader of Brooklyn and whose support was crucial to making Koch the mayor in 1977, was finally convicted on the basis of FBI wiretaps on a man named Fritzi Giovanelli, who was a capo in the Genovese crime family and who was just indicted yesterday for the third time in the murder of a police officer. And it was through a wiretap on Fritzi Giovanelli's home phone that enough probable cause was gathered to put first a wiretap on Esposito and then a bug in his office. And Esposito had many, many meetings with top-ranking mafia figures while he was making judges as well as getting favors and contracts for Mayor Koch. Esposito was finally convicted at a trial last year. Stanley Friedman, the Democratic boss of the Bronx, was law partners with Roy Cohen. And Roy Cohen not only represented the members of the Mafia National Commission, like Carmine Galante before he was assassinated, and then Paul Castellano before he was assassinated, the Mafia Commission actually held meetings in the law offices shared by Roy Cohn and Stanley Friedman, because the mafia leaders believed that they were protected from bugging by the lawyer-client confidentiality statutes. The third pillar of Koch's political support in New York City was Donald Maness. And in the book, we quote the federal prosecutor, Rudolph Giuliani, as saying he believed the real reason Maness committed suicide was that he was so implicated in so many financial transactions with organized crime figures that he could not see any way to cooperate with the government in a limited way about politicians and judges without organized crime believing he was also cooperating about them, and that would put his family in harm and danger. And Giuliani believes that and told us that on the record, which we quote in the book. I think as a result of this combined influence, we describe a lot of the city contracts that have been given to companies controlled by organized crime. There's a company called Arc Plumbing that got a $20 million no-bid contract from the Koch administration, and the company lists John Gotti, now the godfather, as a salesman, and they got the contract to refurbish Shea Stadium, for example. And there are a lot of bus companies and towing companies controlled by organized crime that have received millions of dollars in city contracts.
Well, you've just named three party leaders from the boroughs of New York who helped put Koch in office. Do you think it would have been possible for someone to get elected without affiliating with them and without becoming corrupted by them?
I think it is possible. In the election for governor in New York, when Koch ran for governor against Mario Cuomo, Cuomo did not have the support of any of these party bosses, and he won the election anyway. They all were supporting Koch, and they all were getting more and more patronage favors from Koch, and Cuomo won the election, even though he was not only that Cuomo was outspent by Koch 4-1 in the Democratic primary, and all the party bosses supported Koch. So it can be done. And in other circumstances, politicians have accepted the support of some of these party bosses, but then after they won, have displayed integrity and independence and have not acted beholden to them and have governed in an independent fashion. And I think you have examples of both someone being elected without their support and people being elected with their support but being independent anyways. It's a question of strength of character, I think, and of attentiveness to the job and of not looking the other way and of not feeling so dependent on them that you cave into them and give them all the contracts and jobs and patronage they demand, because you have to know how to stand up to them.
You've been covering Koch for years. You've been covering New York City politics since the mid-60s. Your new book is a national book. It's talking about New York, but for a national audience. What makes the New York scandals an important national story?
Well, one, I think the same preconditions that have caused New York City's government to become so corrupt exist in many other cities. The one-party rule by the Democratic Party, for example, which exists in Philadelphia and in Boston, in Washington, in Chicago, and in all those places where you have one-party rule by either party, in some suburban places like Nassau County and Long Island, where the Republicans had one-party rule, their political boss, Joe Margiotta, was tried and convicted of public corruption. When you have one-party rule and traditional organized crime families based, like South Jersey, like Brooklyn and Queens, like Chicago, like Cleveland, you have a recipe, a formula for corruption. And I think these conditions exist in many places around the country. And part of the power of the party bosses in New York was that they picked all the state judges and picked all the state district attorneys, and they began to feel above the law. And it was only when you had an independent federal United States attorney like Giuliani that he began to investigate and prosecute and convict these people, the way you had Jim Thompson became a crusading U.S. attorney in Illinois or Thornburg in Pennsylvania. You think the solution is also, in many cases, a federal prosecutor to come in and clean up the local corruption of the Democratic machine and organized crime.
What do you think are the most lasting effects on New York City of the organized crime connections to the government?
I think that's harder to say. I think when organized crime gets its hooks into a politician or an administration, it's very cautious, and they keep getting these contracts for companies they control, and maybe once every 2 or 3 years they call someone up and try to fix a case. But I think it's less on a day-to-day basis. It's less the organized crime penetration than it is the corrupt political leaders who take over city agencies, and then they're putting hacks and incompetence into powerful positions by circumventing the civil service law that requires merit testing. Their presence then diminishes and causes a decline in city services. And the corrupt commissioners that Koch had, like Turoff and the Taxi Commission and Amoruso and Transportation, had an effect just on the quality of life in New York City, that basic services stopped getting delivered in a timely and competent fashion because those agencies were being run by crooks. who were more interested in lining their own pockets and concealing their corruption than in actually providing services to the public.
My guest is New York City-based investigative reporter Jack Newfield, who's co-author with Wayne Barrett of the new book City for Sale, Ed Koch and the Betrayal of New York. Newfield wrote for the Village Voice for 24 years and earlier this year moved to the Daily News. When was the last time Ed Koch gave you an interview?
That's a good question. In the introduction to this book, we describe how we interviewed 500 people and read, you know, probably 50 pounds of transcripts. But the one person who wouldn't give us an interview was Mayor Koch. And Mayor Koch, who I used to know very, very well and used to be the lawyer for the Village Voice when I was a young reporter on the Village Voice, when the Village Voice did not support him for mayor in 1977, first announced he would never speak to me, and then announced at a press conference that he would never give any writer for the Village Voice any interviews. And he has maintained that policy. He, you know, right after he was elected, he ran into my wife in a shop in Greenwich Village, and my wife tried to shake his hand and congratulate him, and he wouldn't shake her hand and said, "Eat your heart out, I'm the mayor." And she was quite stunned by this infantile behavior that we usually get from our six-year-old. And he's actually only spoken two words to me in his 12 years as mayor, and those two words were, "You are vile."
Well, it hasn't stopped you from breaking stories about him.
It actually has been a benefit in a way, because for years, Wayne and I and Joe Connison and Bill Bastone at the Village Voice were the only journalists saying that the administration was corrupt from top to bottom. In the daily papers from 1980 to 1986, we're not covering the kind of stories that we were. And because of the mayor's public feud with us, we became like a monopoly, one-stop shopping for all whistleblowers and sources within the government. They would go to the New York Times and be told, "Don't bother, you know, we're not interested in these kind of stories." And they would start lining up at the Village Voice. And as a gift from the mayor, inadvertently, we became a monopoly for whistleblowers. And we did story after story between 1980 and 1986 that people came to us, secretaries, honest people in the bureaucracy who happened to sit near a Xerox machine, and became a great supply of stories and material. And the mayor would constantly have press conferences calling us names, and he once said that they ought to burn down the Village Voice with Newfield in it. And he once gave an interview to Playboy and calling the Village Voice a pornography rag in Playboy.
Well, let's talk about one of
this feud worked out to our benefit.
Well, let's talk about one of the stories that you broke. You broke the story of the Tyler Report. This was this is related to the Bess Meyerson story.
Yes.
There was a report that outlined that Meyerson had given a job to the daughter of the lawyer who was trying the daughter of the judge who was trying the divorce case of Bess Meyerson's lover.
Right. You got it right.
So you had the report. You were leaked the report that outlined
but
all.
It's an interesting story.
Yeah, tell the story.
Harold Tyler was a great lawyer and prosecutor, and when Bess Meyerson took the Fifth Amendment before the federal grand jury about her finances and never even told the mayor she had done that, the mayor appointed Tyler to investigate the case. And Tyler wrote a brilliant 80-page report, scathing report documenting with incredible detail the unethical and perhaps criminal conduct of Bess Meyerson in fixing this divorce case. The mayor got the report and suppressed it. He had originally said he would make it public when he received it, but when he got it, he decided not to make it public. And he released a false and distorted summary, making it sound much more benign than it actually was. Right after that happened, a source of mine in the FBI met me for a drink and said, "Jack, I've read this report. I can't give it to you, but you should drop whatever you're doing and get a copy. Call all your sources. This report is dynamite, and it's an outrage that Koch has suppressed it. It's an outrage that he's released a misleading summary of it." And that day it was revealed in the papers that even after Koch read the report, he had invited Bess Meyerson to a Passover Seder at Gracie Mansion, I think to keep her on his good side. And this source was outraged that Koch even after he read this report, and he was the only person who read it, and the report described chapter and verse how Meyerson had lied to the mayor still invited her to Passover. And I worked on it for about a month and finally found the source, who I can never reveal, who got me a copy of the report. And Wayne and I broke the story of the secret report that was devastating to Bess Meyerson and devastating to Mayor Koch in the Village Voice in June of 1987.
Now, this was the kind of story where you got it, I think, on a Friday and wrote it over the weekend.
Right. There's another funny story because I got it on a Friday, and in the mail after, and then that night I had tickets to the Mets game, where it was going to be Dwight Gooden's first starting assignment since he came out of drug rehab, and it was the greatest moral conflict of my career, whether I'm going to write the scoop about Bess Meyerson or go to see Dwight Gooden's first comeback game from drug rehab. And I ended up going to the game, and Wayne and I spent the whole weekend writing the story, much to the annoyance of our wives and children.
Oh, is this a kind of hold the presses, save the front page
yes,
type of affair?
Yes, yes, it was. And when, as soon as the story came out, all the local TV stations had film crews at the Village Voice, and we were giving interviews all day.
Now, Ed Koch,
it was a big, big scoop and broke open the Meyerson case.
Ed Koch had already spent years not talking to you. Was there anything left that he could do in anger over you breaking the story about his suppression of the story?
Well, yes. He assigned his Department of Investigations to find out who gave us the Tyler Report. Five detectives worked on it full-time for 3 months. Friends of mine were called in and questioned and had their telephone records subpoenaed, and a ferocious effort was made to try to identify our source, and a lot of some innocent people were harassed, and I made a lot of new friends and new sources because people I had never met were scared to death and called in to testify and threatened with prosecution unless they admitted they gave me the report. And the mayor, after spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money, had to admit that his mission was a failure. They never charged anyone with giving us the report, which had been sealed by a judge. And in fact, the judge who sealed it at one point became the leading suspect for giving it to us, which was, and he was harassed.
Oh. Well, I want to talk with you more about your investigative work, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Jack Newfield, who's one of New York City's leading investigative reporters. He's the co-author with Wayne Barrett of the new book City for Sale, Ed Koch and the Betrayal of New York. And Newfield and Barrett had been partners at the Village Voice for around 10 years. Newfield was with the Village Voice for around 24 years, and earlier this year moved to the New York Daily News. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Investigative reporter Jack Newfield is my guest. You were just talking a little bit about some of the hazards of reporting on organized crime and on political corruption. Have you ever been in a potentially life-threatening position as a consequence of a story that you broke?
No, and I don't really think there are that many hazards involved in writing about organized crime. My surprising experience is that it's the more respectable people who probably care more about their reputations and have a greater degree of self-deception or deception involving their family. So when you write something critical about a very respectable person like Mayor Koch, I mean, he tried to get me fired from my job at the Village Voice. But no organized crime person has ever attempted any retaliation against me. And even the more unsavory political bosses we write about in City for Sale, like Stanley Friedman and Meat Esposito, whenever I would write about them in the Village Voice, they would never take it personally, and they would just taunt me and say, you can't hurt me, you're throwing snowballs at a dinosaur, big deal, no one believes you. But I find when you write something revealing about someone like Koch or some liberal politicians who have a facade of respectability, they're the ones who take the most savage revenge. But mob guys consider investigative reporters, you know, an occupational hazard, and don't have the degree of self-deception that I think politicians have.
You mentioned earlier that you used to know Ed Koch on a much more friendly basis. He was the lawyer for a while at the Village Voice, and you mentioned in your book that you were for a while part of the same liberal Greenwich Village circle.
Yes.
And right before Koch started running for mayor, he came to you and told you his dilemma, that he thought he needed to shed his liberal bachelor from Greenwich Village image. Is that where Bess Meyerson comes in?
Well, his media advisor, David Garth, told me with great pride that his job was to take Koch's, in the course of the 77 campaign, that his job was to take the biggest negative, potential negative he saw with Koch, which he was then a 53-year-old bachelor, and Garth was afraid that he would be smeared as a homosexual. And the way to deal with that potential negative was to convert it into a positive, and he got Bess Meyerson then to pretend to be the mayor's girlfriend. And gossip columns started to write that they were may get married after the election. Koch would take Bess Meyerson, who was a heroine at that point, and almost like a feminist Jackie Robinson to a generation of Jewish women, as the first Jewish Miss America, who became Miss America in 1945, the year the concentration camps were liberated, and that she was the first Miss America to have beauty and talent and have a career after Miss America. And they would go to predominantly Jewish parts of the city, and Koch would say, I may have a dramatic announcement about me and Miss Meyerson right after the election. Wouldn't she make a great first lady of New York? I've never met a woman like her. And it was all play acting. It was all a fraud, a charade. There was no sexual or romantic relationship. It was a consumer fraud. And at one point during this campaign, Garth, the media guru, slipped, and he said to me, I have to go meet the Smith brothers. And I said, I don't get it. Who are the Smith brothers? And he says, oh, Koch and Meyerson. And I said, I still don't get it. Why do you call them the Smith brothers? And he looks at me, laughs, and says, two beards, jerk. And it was a very cynical arrangement that Meyerson lent herself to help elect Koch. And it also was another window for me into Koch's character, that he would pander on a death penalty when he didn't even care about it, that he would pretend to be having a romance with somebody in order to get elected. It was almost a frightening sense of a lack of limits.
It also explains why he stayed so loyal to her.
Yes.
I want to quote something that you and Wayne Barrett write about the New York reporter and columnist Jimmy Breslin. You say, For years, journalists went to Cambodia, South Africa, Poland, and Lebanon to find and write prize-winning stories, but Jimmy Breslin mostly stayed close to home. It seems to me that describes you, too.
Exactly right. I mean, in the 60s, I wrote two books of a national orientation, a book about the early civil rights and anti-war movements called The Prophetic Minority, and a book called Robert Kennedy, a Memoir, which was about my friendship with Robert Kennedy. And after the events of 1968, I made a conscious decision to do exactly what I described Breslin doing, stick primarily, although not exclusively, to writing about one place and try to make a difference, try to understand how power actually works in one location and try to write so that you can have an improving or hygienic effect on the government of one city.
Now, you've not only, for most of your career, you were not only in New York, but you were also at the Village Voice, which was a weekly, an alternative weekly. I mean, it wasn't like the New York Times, which is a kind of national newspaper anyway.
Absolutely right.
What kinds of liberties were you able to take at the Village Voice that you thought perhaps you wouldn't be able to do in your reporting at a daily?
I really can't name any. I think the Voice was, you know, quite professional. I had a superb libel lawyer, and I don't detect any difference in terms of taking liberties between the Daily News, which has 1,300,000 readers, and the Village Voice, which had about 150,000 readers. It's the same rigorous libel vetting.
What kept you there?
I ask myself that question now. habit, inertia.
Uh-huh.
familiarity. I mean, I loved some of the colleagues and people I worked with there, like Jim Ridgway and Nat Hentoff, and it was just a comfortable place to be. And a confluence of circumstances led to my accepting the offer from the Daily News to be a once-a-week columnist and a deputy city editor for investigations. And it's worked out well. It's a much bigger audience. It's a chance to communicate with the working class of New York, black and white, and give them information that they might not otherwise be getting through the rest of the media. And there was some sense of preaching to the converted and to a more narrow and elitist, as well as smaller audience at the Village Voice.
Your book ends with a quote from U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani, who is the U.S. attorney who prosecuted a lot of the corrupt figures who figure into the story that you tell about New York City politics. And you quote him as saying, "The political establishment does not understand that law enforcement has changed." Well, the book ends on a very optimistic note by quoting Giuliani, but I was wondering if you believed that yourself.
I think, I mean, in New York City and in most cities, there are cycles of scandal and corruption followed by eras of reform. In New York City, we had Boss Tweed in the last century and then a reform mayor. Then we had the Walker scandal administrations followed by LaGuardia and a reform fusion administration. In the 60s, we had Mayor Lindsay follow the corrupt reign of Carmine DiSapio. So there is always corruption, but there is also, you know, excesses and limitations. And I think we're about to go into an era of reform. I think that law enforcement has become more sophisticated, particularly Giuliani and the FBI office in New York, in targeting corrupt politicians, in targeting corrupt power brokers, building up a database about their activities, their the ways in which they make and conceal money. And I think when you read the book, you will see some of these very sophisticated techniques described, particularly in the Esposito chapter, and how they tracked this guy for 4 years until they got the probable cause to put a wiretap on him.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Jack Newfield, who, along with Wayne Barrett, wrote the new book City for Sale, Ed Koch and the Betrayal of New York. It's published by Harper & Row. And Newfield is the deputy city editor of the New York Daily News and formerly wrote for the Village Voice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.